Blog Talk Radio.
You're the light, you're the night, you're the color of my blood. You're the cure, you're the pain, you're the only thing I want to touch.
Welcome to Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Join us as we bring weekly cultural topics right here to our studio. You, as our studio audience, are welcome to chime in and call the studio or join us on chat. Because, you know, at Cultural Conversations, we believe that cultural issues really do shape and impact our world. So, join us as we discuss the hottest topics and the cultural issues of our day. Stay tuned.
Well, welcome and good evening. We're in for another session of Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Well, this week, it's been a busy week on the media as we still focused on the unrest in Baltimore. Mainly, tonight's topic will focus on the role of women, especially Black women, in mothering and guiding their sons and actually their sons and daughter in the light of Toya Graham's actions and her acceptance in the media in the role she took in guiding her son and disciplining her son on video in regards to stopping him from throwing rocks at the police, which could have caused him to be shot. We're just going to put it out there. Again, this is Cultural Conversations with your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. If you would like to call our show tonight, I'm just going to take care of some housekeeping issues. If you would like to call our show tonight, please do at 347-857-3121. We have a special guest that will be joining us just a second later in regards to her research and a very powerful article that she wrote on a Black mother's love. And this is going to be very important that we pay attention, that we add our voice to the scene here, and that we add our two cents in. I've been getting a lot on media, on social media. Thank you very much for adding your voice, adding your fingers, letting that keyboard do the talking on social media. You're also welcome to join us tonight as we talk with Dr. Robin Borlon. Robin Borlon is going to be with us a little later in our show to talk about her article, A Black Mother's Love. Not only talk about her article, but talk about what's the future of Black women. Can we get back to disciplining our children without someone else's culture really influencing how we discipline our children? We're going to put it out there like that tonight here on Cultural Conversations. Again, if you would like to call the show, please call the show at 347-857-3121. You are invited to have a voice. Also, of course, have a listening ear. If at any time during the show that you would like to join in, please call us at, again, our online studio is 347-857-3121. Talking a little bit about the show. For the last couple of weeks I've focused on the role of the police in protecting and being invited into our neighborhoods and to cultural or communities of color neighborhoods. I've had some experts that have joined us, and I just want to take this time out to say thank you for everyone and all of the experts and the people who have added their voice, whether you're a community activist, whether you're a psychologist, everyone who has added their voice to cultural conversation on this issue and on other issues. I respect your place in society, and I respect what you give to society as well. Listening audience, I want to hear your voice on this, or you can sit back and, of course, listen. But just to give you some information about tonight's show, we will open up the chat room. At least the chat room is open now. And so if you would like to pose a question in the chat room or a scenario or go over a particular issue that we can run by Dr. Robin Boyle on tonight, please do engage us in the chat room here at Cultural Conversations. If you would like to call in the show, please do. The number is 347-857-3121. Let's give you a bit of history or a bit of information about tonight's show. Cultural Conversations tonight will reflect on the Baltimore riots, the role a Black mother played in becoming an iconic figure in media and in her community. We welcome Dr. Robin Boylong, educator, writer with Crunk Feminist Collective, to the show. Dr. Boylong will talk about her article, A Black Mother's Love, or What Love Looks Like in Public, which reflected on the actions of the Baltimore Mother of the Year and society's reaction and understanding of the role Black mothers must take in leadership, and I mean in leading her household and leading in her community and having command over those that she is charged to raise, to guide, to supervise, her role. And so we're going to talk to Dr. Robin Boylong. And just, I will let Robin give you some history about who she is and how she got to this point, her research interests, and all that good academic stuff in a moment. Again, if you would like to call the show, please do at 347-857-3121. If you would like to get online and ask a question online in our online studio, please follow the prompts to get into the studio, and we'll get you there. You're listening to Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. We'll be back in just one moment.
I'll give you all of me, but still ain't enough to make you happy. I'll give you everything, but you still don't measure up. It's like I walked 5,000 miles and didn't even come close. It feels like I try to make you smile, but you don't even care, no.
Joining me here on Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Tonight we have as our special guest Dr. Robin Boylong. Robin Boylong earned her doctorate in 2009 from the University of South Florida, and currently she is assistant professor of interpersonal and intercultural communications at the University of Alabama, where she teaches and writes about issues of social identity, diversity, and focusing primarily on the lived experiences of Black women. Dr. Boylong, you are on the air with Cultural Conversations. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Boylong, before we get started, we have several people online right now, so that just lets me know that we have a pretty large listening audience right now. So just give a background, a little little bit of background about yourself, who you are, where you yield from your research interests.
Well, I am originally from North Carolina. I grew up in a small town in North Carolina for most of my life. And then, as you indicated, I earned my PhD at the University of South Florida. So I lived in Florida for 6 years. And now I'm in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where I teach at the university. So I'm Southern at heart. I'm definitely a Southern country girl at heart. And I was raised by a single mother in a matrifocal household with strong, independent, witty Black women. So that is the center of my life and my scholarship is Black women and, you know, telling our stories, representing our lives in ways that are often muted in research, in educational research.
Now, your educational background is pretty impressive because when I looked at, you know, when I read your bio and I saw ethnography, and I was like, okay, she deals with culture. So she's not only studying her own, but she's studying how other cultures impact and how they intersect. Could you give our listening audience a little bit about that? Because then it'll help us set the tone for us to at least dive into a cultural realm with the actions that we're seeing in Baltimore with Black women.
Yes, so I primarily use ethnographic and autoethnographic method. And ethnography, as you know, is an anthropological method where you go into a community or a culture different than your own and you participate as if you were a member of that culture. You get to know it intimately so that you can understand it and describe it on the verge of being an insider-outsider. So a lot of my research does that. And autoethnography is actually a way of engaging culture, but yourself in culture. So it's like mirroring your own experience and your own standpoint in culture. So a lot of my research is focused on my experience as a Black woman in a predominantly white culture, be that the university, be that, you know, different contexts of how I'm seen and how I am different. And so I have to explain myself and situate myself in contexts that don't always understand my own cultural background. So being able to see Black culture, for example, or Southern culture or rural culture from a critical standpoint and lens, and then describe it to people who are not familiar with those communities enables me to situate them inside in the context of my life to understand different experiences that I have in those inside and outside of those contexts.
Right. This is going to be very interesting. Your article, your very, very powerful article that hit, I'm going to say, last weekend, I'm thinking, it hit.
Yes, last Tuesday.
Could you tell us, last weekend, and it has gotten much buzz. It's a Black mother's love, or what love looks like in public. Give us a little synopsis about that article.
Well, the article, what is, I had intended to write about the uprising in Baltimore, but I felt like I had run out of words in terms of pleading for social justice and Black lives. So I didn't feel confident that I had anything new or compelling to say that I hadn't already said. But I had seen the viral video of Toya Graham and her son, and we didn't even know her name at the time, circulating on Facebook. And so I decided that I wanted to write about that. It was actually haunting me in the best of ways the night before. So not haunting me in a bad way, but just staying on my mind. And I thought about it and woke up thinking about it and decided that I wanted to write about my impressions of that video. I hesitated at first because I knew that the argument I was going to make about her demonstrating love might be controversial, but I felt very strongly about it. And one of the reasons I knew it would be controversial, and this is before she was deemed Mother of the Year by media and conservative media, but I knew that the image of a Black mother physically confronting her son could be seen in many different ways. Some people saw it and probably perceived her hitting him in anger, which is never okay. That some people may have saw it and perceived abuse, which is never okay. But I saw it, and I saw her fear for her son. I saw a mother's fear for her son wrapped up in love. I saw her trying to protect him. I saw her trying to save him, and I wanted to write that out because I felt that even though she would, because at the time I was assuming she would be demonized, which is one of, so my piece was to counter that, right, to anticipate people saying she's a terrible mother by explaining how and why she was mothering the way that she was and how the black mothers who have lost their children didn't have the opportunity to do what she was doing, which was to snatch their child out of a situation that could leave them breathless, literally.
Mm-hmm. I saw that too, and I'm pretty sure other people saw that. And on the flip side, I saw that she didn't have time to really reel her actions or her motives in. It was almost right. As a knee-jerk reaction of the things that we do when we get home. You know, regardless of what society, what the role or the behavior or the guidelines or rule that society will enact or will enforce on us, when we get home and we tell our child and our child is looking at us eye to eye, or sometimes we have to look up at this almost boy child, boy man, I call him boy man,
right?
Because they're about big as a man, but they're children. They're children, and they think they know what's best for them. When you have to shake a child up, that's the term I use. You see that happening in your own intimate settings in your own home. And then even when you go out on the street, you say, child, don't have me embarrass you out there, and don't you have me embarrass myself out there. It almost means that don't have me go on the limb, shake you up, and have the authorities not understanding why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Right.
Could you expound
absolutely.
On
it can be misconstrued.
Yes. But what happened in our black culture where it became not cool to discipline your child in order to save their life? There had to be a moment in time, in a historical timeline, that became uncool.
I think that, you know, I think a lot of it has to do, because I think that sometimes there is this public admonition of disciplining children in a particular way, or an expectation that children should be raised in a particular way, that is most popular in the mainstream, but that does not mean that it's always adopted in individual cultural spaces, because I think that there is a way in which, you know, when we become, when we go away from home and we become educated and we learn different ways of thinking and engaging, that we then sometimes take those things back home. I don't have children of my own, but I know how I was raised and how the children in my community were raised, and we turned out okay, right? And then I also know how I would hope to raise my children, and I would hope that I would be able to raise them differently in some context. But I think that that the judgment that happens sometimes when people decide, I would raise my child this way, or I would raise my child that way, particularly when that comes from people who don't have children, it's easy to say what you would do if it's not your child. And I don't have children, so I can empathize with folk who say we need to do better, because there are definitely things about how I was reared and in the context in which I was reared that I would change if I were to have a child. But I would never demonize or judge the way that the women in my community and the women in my family historically have raised their children and loved their children, because they're doing the best they can, particularly single mothers. Because there's a way in which, like you said, these man boys or boy men, these children, there's a way in which they will not react and respond to their mother in the way that they will to their father and or a father figure and or any other man, right? So sometimes women, black women, have to adopt masculine modes of communicating in order to get their attention. And that's not always a positive thing, but it's oftentimes a necessary thing that they have to do to protect their children. I think that, you know, that I think that Toya was thinking in that moment, these people will kill you and hide their hands and act like they didn't do anything and there will be no consequences. And so she was trying to protect her son. And Black mothers are usually only allowed to react and respond in certain ways with their children in public, but there's no reasonable way to react when you think your child is in danger. You protect them, you save them, you snatch them, you slap them, you do whatever you have to do to get them home safe.
Right. You talked about that in your article. You compared, or I don't want to say compared, you looked at the reactions and the advocacy and the protests by some women who lost their children, who were very popular in the media. You talked about the Trayvon Martin case and the way that the mother reacted. You talked about several other cases, Tamar Rice, Tamir Rice's mother, the way she reacted, and Mike Brown's mother. In reading the verdict, I remember her standing on, I don't know whether she was standing on some bleachers or a chair or something with a whole group of people, the way she reacts. You looked at each with a critical eye. Why was that important to kind of look at it and put that in context of Black womanhood?
Because I think that Black womanhood and Black motherhood can't be distinguished in these moments. And the thing that I think is necessary to critique is respectability politics, and this expectation that even in the midst of loss and potential loss, as is the case with Toya Graham, that these mothers are graded almost on how they respond and act in public, particularly their public perception and persona, because I think there's no way for us to know what it's like behind closed doors. But when we have Sabrina Fulton, Trayvon Martin's mother, she had a very respectable demeanor, and she was presented as a very respectable mother. So when her son died, her anger was subdued. Then we have Leslie McSpadden, Michael Brown's mother, and she was very belligerent, as she had every right to be, because her son was murdered and there was no consequence. Jordan Davis's mother was another respectable representation, and Tamir Rice's mother was not. So I feel like the way that the media portrays Black mothers in these contexts is very important, particularly when we think about, okay, so how now are they going to frame Toya Graham? Now, they ended up framing her positively, but there was no way for us to anticipate that, given how Black mothers have been framed previously, particularly because she didn't have a quote-unquote respectable reaction to her son being out there. She didn't have what would be seen as a rational reaction to mainstream media. So I was actually very surprised. But then when I realized and recognized that the reason Toya Graham was being heralded as Mother of the Year had nothing to do with, she would be judged in the same way outside of that context. It was a context in which she did it, because the people who were celebrating her, that she did what they wanted to do, which was to go and confront and, you know, kind of drag these young people away. And so she did what they wanted to do, and so they wanted to recognize and privilege her for doing that. But if she was anywhere else in any other context and she snatched her son up and made him go home, it wouldn't matter if he was in danger. Child Protective Services would have been called. So it's somewhat hypocritical of media to frame her this way when they say Samaria Rice and Leslie McSpadden are irrespectable mothers.
You know, you said something that's very important. It's just the content on which her actions were viewed. You know, even in my own situation, raising two males, just about single, you know, single family, single parent, raising two boys, and when they got to the age of high school, I'm looking up at them. They're 6 feet. I'm, 5'5"? They're 6 feet in high school. You know, the one is like 5'9", the other is like, 6 feet. Okay, so, and one, get up, go to school. You don't even have to wake him up. He'll get up, go to school, goodbye, have a nice day, love it. The other one, he didn't like school too much. So it was a challenge. One day, the one who didn't like school too much. I can remember this distinctively because I felt that I was going to have to do something drastically because he was getting out of hand. He decided he was going to sleep in, and I said, okay. I woke him up once, and I said, if I have to come back and wake you up, because I don't want you to miss the bus, but I have to come back and wake you up and wake you up with cold water. And I can remember this. And so I didn't hear anything for like 5 minutes, no rumbling, no yawning, no getting up, no cussing. You know, usually it's like throwing shoes or doing something to the test. Okay, nothing. I go back downstairs. I said, okay, get up. He looked up. He sat up on the side of the bed, and he raised his hand like he was going to punch me. I will never forget this. And I said, boy, if you ever, I will kill you right where you stand. I will beat the shit out of you.
Uh-huh.
I said that.
Uh-huh.
And he was still mad, angry. So he gets ready to go to school. And he's pushing his sister, he's pushing everybody, because now he's bigger than all of us. And I said,
right.
Oh, wait. I said, wait, you're going to go to school, and you're going to go to school right. Or I said, it's going to be me and you. So he calls himself, you know how you braise up on somebody, you braise up with your chest on
yes.
me like I was another guy. And I had to sock him. And I socked him.
Mm-hmm.
He went to school. He went to school crying. And so maybe about 20 minutes after he got to school, I got a call. Come to school. So I go to school. There's a room. This is the principal room of white women, I'm going to say. And they're looking all wringing their hands, and they're looking really sad and everything. And my child sitting in the corner with crocodile tears in his eyes. I really don't care. He's in school. That's where he's supposed to be. And so the administrators proceeded to question me about what happened in my household that morning that made him, my child, so upset. And I said, you know what happened? I demanded that he got up and go to school. And he tried to lick
right.
his hand like he was going to hit me. And I told him, if you ever hit me, it's going to be me and you. And you might, boy, I will kill you where you stand. Now, that didn't mean I'm going to actually kill my child.
Of course.
That's
right,
actually,
of course.
Man, I'm going to make you respect me this day. And I said, then he braised up on me and tried to push me and his sister, and I socked him. And I said, and then he got out and he went to school. And so this woman was like, oh, no, my goodness. You made him feel that works on his emotions, and it works on his self-esteem, and it works on all of this stuff she's bringing out that's indicative for her culture. That's how you raise your kids, with them cussing
mm-hmm.
at you, with them giving wild rave parties in your house uncontrollably, but not here. And so it was
right.
so difficult for her and for the group of her colleagues to understand, I'm dealing with something different. I'm dealing with trying to keep this child from becoming a statistic, because he can't raise up to people like that. He can't raise
right.
up to go around in this suburb and get
right.
out of the car with his friend. And when a police asks him a question, he's going to raise up to a police officer. I don't think so. But she couldn't understand
right.
that. She was more like, no, we want to be nice, and we really want to feed into his emotions, and we want to reward him for when he's good. But when he's bad, we don't want to talk about the negative point. And it was so hard and difficult to say, lady, we live in two different worlds here.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to applaud you again for writing an article that hit home, that black women, we got to do what we got to do. We're not out to kill
right.
our children. We're out to raise a civilization, really.
Right.
That has kept going and going and going. And we're still here through slavery, through Middle Passage, through everything. We are still here. So at least give us credit for that.
Right. Absolutely.
So your intended audience, when you wrote this article, who was it meant to be written for?
I think that initially, I always write to our CFC readers, but I was also hoping to reach an audience of people who might have had a snap judgment about Toya and not giving the situation a nuanced interrogation, right? So I wanted to, I knew that the video had been circulating, and I knew that people probably made up their minds immediately as to what happened and what was going on. But I wanted to remind people that this was not made for TV, right? She was not putting on for the camera. She didn't even notice or pay attention that the camera was there. She was very focused on her son. She was concentrating on her child. And so it wasn't about I'm being videoed. People are going to think this, that, or the third about me and or my son. It's about making sure that my son is safe. And I wanted to represent a perspective that I wasn't sure would have been represented otherwise. And I wasn't attempting to speak for Toya. I was attempting to speak for Black women who are misunderstood, misrepresented, and misunderstood in terms of how they love, what it looks like. And I think that it's problematic. I was actually talking to one of the CFs about this after posting the article, about how it's problematic that in our culture, because of how we were raised and where we grew up and what we see and how Black mothers love and how Black mothers have to love their children to save their children, that sometimes love and violence looks the same from a distance in public. Because I'm saying that this looks like love, but it also looks like violence. And so it was really telling for me that I saw love and someone else could look at it and see violence. So I wanted to represent the love in the moment of what was going on and how she was feeling and how it was fear motivating her and not anger toward him, and that we need to pay attention to that. And also, you know, I think in some of the reactions to the article have ranged from people understanding and agreeing to people completely disagreeing. But I think or claiming that that me justifying Toya's right to mother in that way in that moment is somehow a justification for intimate partner or domestic violence in general, which it is not, because there's a very particular relationship between Black mothers and their sons. Just as you described from your own personal experience, it would not be the same if it was Toya White confronting her daughter. That would not have been appropriate. It would not be appropriate for a man to approach a woman that way, or even another man to approach another man that way. But we're talking very specifically about a Black mother trying to raise a Black son, a Black man child who, you know, is smelling himself a little bit, feels like he knows better and can do what he wants to do, and is probably a little belligerent and frustrated, and rightfully so. How can she keep him from no longer existing on this earth? That's the main thing. And so sometimes loving your child might not look like love to people who are watching, and it might not feel like love to your child in that moment, but if it saves them, that's the ultimate goal in that moment, because it was very volatile and dangerous for him to be instigating a confrontation with a police officer in an already volatile situation.
Thank you for actually dissecting that, you know, no, Toya Grand did not go out there seeking some notoriety when she disciplined her 16-year-old son. You know, oftentimes I do hear that, you know, I'm giving you these strict restrictions at home, or I'm enforcing this curfew, or I'm grounding you, or you know, and I grew up in the age where people spanked children, and they didn't, individuals or adults, they didn't get the repercussions from society for spanking your child. They spanked you.
Right.
And even if you had you had uncles or aunts or cousins or brothers or sisters who were older than you, and your mother and father left them to babysit you or in their charge, they had the right of protecting you and disciplining you the way that your mom and dad disciplined you. Not to kill you. No, we're not talking about abuse. We're talking about guidance.
Of course.
And we're talking
correction.
About that. I remember that time when we had that in our community, but it comes with a lot of trust as well. And it comes with a lot of community looking out for each other. So I grew up in a time where the next door neighbor, when, you know, the next door neighbor heard you use a bad word or profanity, or you disrespected somebody down the street, the next door neighbor would get on you and say, well, as soon as I see your parents, I'm going to tell your parents what you did, and your parents shook you up, and there was no problem with that. But I think the problem came when there was an assimilation, or what we tried to do is assimilate into others' culture and apply that to our own. We don't share the same historical pattern. And, you know, I'm talking to you, Robin, it's like I'm talking to the choir here. We don't share the same historical pattern, so how could we regulate and guide the same way?
Right.
And so,
absolutely.
Because
racism is a serious thing.
This is not to bash white culture, because there is a white culture. Whether people want to, I live in Minnesota. There is a white culture. There's definitely defined lines, but I can never 100% assimilate into that. I still carry some of the ways that I do things and people who look like me and people who share a common interest. I still do that. I still do things that way. And so could you expound a little bit on that cultural aspect?
I think that, you know, one of the main cultural aspects that oftentimes gets dismissed or, swept under the rug is the role of racism here. And that's the thing that distinguishes Black culture or distinguishes white culture from other cultures, right, is that in this country, your race matters, and it can, it determines how people see you. And it's dangerous for all Black people, but there's a peculiar way in which Black males are perceived, and they are stereotyped as criminal-minded and dangerous, which is one of the reasons why when people take the lives of a Black man or a Black child, young man, that they can always claim they were afraid for their own life. And so Black mothers are afraid for their children's lives because they know that I know you. I know your heart. Despite what you look like, despite, you know, how you wear your hair or how you wear your clothes, you know, like we within our own community know how complicated and layered we are as human beings. But when you are stereotyped and misrepresented in larger culture, and they see you in a particular way and they can't see past that, then it requires additional protection for children because of systemic racism. So racism and white privilege are things that can't be overlooked in the conversation around cultural difference, because that makes all the difference in the world. Raising a white child versus raising a Black child in this country it makes all the difference in the world. My son would be seen as a potential delinquent no matter what he does. He would be seen as a threat no matter what he does. And a white child would be given the benefit of the doubt no matter what he did. And that in and of itself means that I have to teach my child to be on his best behavior no matter what, even to, in some ways, to scale back his passion toward social justice at a particular age, because you're too young to rein in all of those emotions, and someone could hurt you and you won't be able to defend yourself. Because when I think about Trayvon Martin and how he had every right to react and respond the way he did to being stalked by George Zimmerman, yet he didn't live to tell about it. You know, he could very well have been taught you can't react that way. So as a result of Trayvon Martin's death, there's another mother teaching her son, you have to be careful. If this mm-hmm. happens, you have to do this. If someone approaches you, you need to do that, because you never know what someone is going to do to you. And that's a danger that's very unique to Black mothers about their sons, their daughters as well. But Black boys are seen as deviant, defiant, and dangerous in a way that even Black women and girls are not.
Yeah. You know, Just like I mentioned before, and I'm going to tie this into what you're saying about the warnings or the conversation we give to our now children, both boys and girls, but historically it has been passed. It has been, you know, the conversation we give to our boys. And I don't know what men say to their sons. I'm thinking it's the same conversation. I can only speak to what I told my son, that at a certain age that you have to be careful. You can't do the same things as your white friends do and get away with it. It was a hard conversation for them to hear as portions of their life. They grew up in a black community, and then all of a sudden I uproot them in, you know, portions of your kind of teenage adolescence life. You grew up in a suburban community, which, you know, they have some African Americans, mainly at some Africans, and I have to explain that's different. That is a different way of acting or a different culture. And then the white culture, which they're friends, everybody is friends. And I said, but people, society doesn't look at you as being all equal. I said, not that you're not equal, but society is not going to treat you that way. And I said, society is going to fear you. And I remember, you know, my sons really having a hard time trying to grasp that. They say, Mom, it sounds so racist that they would look at us as different and they would treat us different. And lo and behold, different things happen where if it's somebody's driving a car, they never stop this one guy who's driving a car without a driver's license, without any tags or whatever, but they'll stop you and you have insurance tags, driver's license and everything. No reason for the stop. They just stop you just checking if everything is okay with the car or whatever. And now it becomes a pattern. So I don't know what people tell their children, but I think it's okay to put the race issue out there and say our society is not well when it comes down to race. And you could be, you will be targeted. You could be targeted. And I don't think that's a racist action, but I see a lot of parents not telling their kids, you know, just because they live in suburbia. And they think that everything is great here, great school, great home, that they forget that society is still looking at your child in a certain way, especially those police officers are.
Absolutely.
What messages, Dr. Moreland, what messages should, as women, as black women, should we be in reinforcing at home with our kids?
I think that you know, it's important to be honest with our children. And race is a thing. And I think that race and racism is something that all parents need to talk to their children about. You know, many of the students that I teach are oftentimes caught off guard when I bring race up and I talk about racism in the classroom. And, you know, particularly my white students will sometimes say things like, well, I'm colorblind or I don't see color. And I explained to them that that is not only untrue, but problematic. Because, yes, you do. You do see color. It's okay to see color. It's not racist to see color. And I also explained to them that, you know, whether or not it makes us uncomfortable, whether or not we grow up in, you know, in integrated spaces, race is and will always be an issue and a marker of difference for those who are not white. There will always be privilege to being light or white, and disprivileged to not being. And we have to prepare our children for that. Imagine not teaching your child that their race matters. Then they'd be confronted with it and they don't know what to do. You know what I'm saying? So it's one thing for you to let them know, and then hopefully they never have an interaction wherein something happens that is racially motivated. That could be our desire. But just in case, because if it does, if and when it happens, it's going to be something that they need to know how to react to and how to respond to and what to do if and when that happens. So I don't think that it's okay for black parents to not let their children know. You have to, you know, and it doesn't mean that you have to teach them anything wholly negative, right? My mother never sat me down and said we are she never blatantly said we are seen as less because we're black. She just said you have to do twice as much to get half as far because you're black. These people will expect you to not know what you're doing because you're black. You have to always be on your P's and Q's because you're black, right? She didn't necessarily explain why, but she also didn't have to.
Right.
Because I think that this generation is much more, you know, they're growing up in a much more pluralistic society than we did, and they are much more optimistic about race relations. But at the end of the day, racism is still a thing, and it's something that they need to be prepared for, and they need to understand. And whether that just be you let them know when this happens, this is how you have to react regardless of what your white friends are doing, you know, because they're going to be seen a particular way and you're going to be seen a particular way, because it's just the reality that we live in, and it's irresponsible, I believe, to not prepare our children for that. And sometimes preparing them for that means being hard on them, because the world is going to be hard on them. And I would rather, if I had a child, I would rather I want to be your teacher. I don't want this police officer to teach you that you're black and that means something. I want to be the one to teach you that, so that you can take pride in it, and so that you can have some context around it, rather than just feeling like being black is a burden, because it's not only a burden, it's just a context in our culture and in our country that is disadvantaged because of white privilege, but it doesn't mean that it's bad or innately bad or that you're innately anything.
I want to get back to the kind of the questioning that we were doing right before the show and flushing out that one question, like what is that? What would be the role, either past or present, that black women can play? And I think at this point we've embraced the fact that, yes, we are single mothers, we're single parents. We've been that since through slavery. This hasn't just been something that has just come up. Our families have been torn apart. They look different. I don't want to say torn apart in a negative way. Our family structure looks quite different, but we make it work. We're still alive. We're still on this earth. We're still functioning, given the fact that we were delayed for 100 years, almost 400 years here in this country. We still have the Dr. Borlons to look at what we have achieved. So I'm looking at this. Okay, we will take that hit. We are single parents. We got kids. We have to raise them. That's our future. That's our legacy. We'll continue on. We'll continue to live. How can we now get back in the game? Because we have been taken out of the game in disciplining our children, really. I mean, all it takes is like 911, my mama's beating me. But, you know, you can be on the bus or you can be on a train cussing up a storm or disrespecting your elders. That's okay. Other people, the police can come in, put their foot on your neck, beat the hell out of you or kill you, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now when those police officers are getting charged, now you want to bring in the mothers. Like, please bring back the mothers so that they can discipline their children so they can take the heat off of us. So I'm looking at this as an opportunity for us to look at some reform and to put our foot back in the game of where it needs to be in public. We don't want to kill our children, of course not, but we do want to have a say and how our children are raised, not only at home, but even in schools. What are the expectations? You know, I don't want my son telling off his teacher because she's a white, docile, afraid, fragile teacher, and she can't teach him because she's so afraid of him, so she's letting him do whatever he wants in the classroom, and I've seen it. Whatever he wants, she will justify it and say, oh, that's okay. Just, we're going to put him by the door. We'll just let, when he acts up, we'll sit him outside in the hallway so he won't disturb the rest of the kids. Whereas I've seen kids who say, I don't want a black teacher because a black teacher is going to get in my face and not going to let me do those things. So I'm looking at this doctor, as an opportunity for us to get back in the game of really having a say over how our children, how individuals interact with our children in regards to disciplines and guidance. What do you say about that? How your article, it opened up a Pandora's box now, and it's causing a stir. What do we do with what you've charged us in the article? How can we get back in the game?
I think it's complicated. It's so much more complicated than I could have even expressed in the article, because it's very contextual. I believe that in any other context, had Toya Graham confronted her son and gotten physical with her son, Child Protective Services would have been called. The same people who are praising her would have been admonishing her. And I think that, too, is problematic. And another reason that it's problematic is because Black mothers are and have historically been made responsible for the actions of their children, particularly when it's considered bad behavior or deviant behavior. Then it's the mother's fault. It's always like, well, where is the mother? Why didn't she intervene? But then when she intervenes, she's oftentimes penalized for intervening, particularly if it means punishing her child or doing something that is deemed inappropriate in terms of disciplining her child, whether that be corporal punishment or anything that might be misinterpreted, you know, in public spaces. And I think children will take advantage of that to whatever degree that they can. So it's hard for me to say what our intervention can be, because I don't know that, I don't think that, because I don't think there's anything extraordinary about Toya Graham. You know, that's another reason why I find some of the rhetoric around, you know, her, she being Mother of the Year and all of that. I'm not compelled to buy into that, because she's not doing anything that so many other Black mothers are not currently doing and haven't been doing. But she's being praised for it. They're being punished for it. Mm-hmm. They're all just trying to raise their children. They're all trying to make sure that they're good citizens and that they can contribute, you know, to our society in positive ways before it's too late, because there's going to be a moment when it's too late for the mother to intervene. And so it's complicated, because I want to say that we've been doing it, and I think that we have been, but there's just been punishments for the parents for intervening. If there's a way to demonize a Black mother, it usually happens. So what I'm hoping can happen from this situation is that people can reassess and reimagine and rethink what mothering looks like, particularly Black sons, what it looks like, what it has to look like, because Black masculinity is its own thing. It's its own animal. And, you know, the ways in which Black boys have to protect and cover up and disguise their vulnerability, which becomes a performance of hyper masculinity and cool posing. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't always do that with your mama, right? But there's also the idea that we have to keep in mind that, you know, but there's still what happens when they feel emasculated, because this could also be emasculating. And if they're so desperate to hold on to their masculinity or to prove their masculinity, then they may demonstrate it in other ways. And if not against their mother, then someone else, you know, taking it out on someone else. And I think that those are valid concerns. But I think in terms of parenting and mothering and being able to do it on our own terms, I feel like we always should be able to do that without the fear of being judged by other people, and without the fear of having your children taken away. But those are very real. Those are very real concerns, and there's concerns that are backed up by policies. So, you know, it would be easy for me to say, not even having a child, that mother should do this, she should do X, or should be able to do X. But if and when she does X, there's a very serious consequence to that, which could include having her child taken away from her, being deemed an unfit mother because she's trying to raise her child. So it's complicated, and I don't think that there's an easy answer for it. I share your frustration in believing that we should be able to raise our children the way that we want to. And we also have to think about the class critique here as well, right? Because in addition to race, I think that, you know, racial difference in terms of how children are parented, I think it's also a class issue. It's also an education issue, you know. And, you know, so we, it's like you know better, you should do better, or you know different, you should do different in terms of how you're raising your children. And I can get down with that too. But I also have to admit that there are certain things about, there's certain instincts, I think, that kick in when you have to protect your child, where all of that other stuff goes out the window, where my PhD and my training and my feminism goes out the window when I'm just trying to make sure my child makes it home alive, because so many don't.
Yeah. Dr. Borland, we have a caller who would like to get in on the conversation. Caller from 240, you're on the air with Cultural Conversation, Dr. Borland.
How you doing, Dr. Borland? This is Ty from the Maryland, D.C. area. I did have a question, and it's a very circular round question, but I wanted to know your take on this. Certainly, you do have quite a few single mothers, and we had those for a long time, and the matriarchal household has been around for a long time. One aspect that I see that sometimes a lot of people, I think they look at it, but it kind of is like, okay, is the fact that within the household you will have a little girl as well. You have sons, yes, but you have little girls. And usually when they look at mom, you know, to some extent they mimic the fact that this is a single household and it's the woman or the young girl that seemed to have more responsibility to look after her brothers and look after this person and that person. Think to some degree that creates a little bit of an idea for the younger girl that is her permanent position in life, to basically be a mother for whoever she ends up with later. Do you think that they overlook the certain leadership skills in a man because they never see that and they just figure they can take care of it?
That's an interesting question. I think that there are definitely these little girls growing up in these contexts. Myself, I'm also one who, and there are certain gender roles that they adopt sometimes out of necessity in terms of being a caregiver, being given particular types of responsibilities at a young age to do particular things in the home. Sometimes those are gendered things, sometimes not. You know, sometimes they're given responsibilities that even older male siblings are not. And I don't know how that would translate to a relationship. I don't think that it let me rephrase this. What I think the issue here is isn't the presence or influence of the single present mother, influence of the absent father, whether he be known or unknown, if he's not physically there. Because sometimes I think we blame Black mothers for teaching their daughters to be independent and self-sufficient and not need a man. But that's not really something that the mother has taught her daughter. That's something that the father has required of the daughter. If my father is not there and I don't have that perspective or that that person to lean on, he's teaching me to be independent. He's requiring me to be self-sufficient, not the mother, because the mother and I, we're just trying to survive. We're just trying to make it and get by the best way we know how. But I don't know that that the responsibility of the ways in which that might influence the young girl as she grows up and as she may be leery of trusting someone else can take care of her when she's never seen that. I think that that's possible, but I don't think that the responsibility of that is solely on the mother, who is just trying to take care of her and teach her how to take care of herself and teach her how to take care of others. A lot of times by necessity, I think, not so much you need to know this, but you have to know this, because when I'm at work, somebody has to cook. When I'm over here, somebody has to do this, and things that, you know, just necessity in terms of living and getting by. Does that make sense?
That does. You know, and I noticed, and the only reason I asked that question, because I noticed that at an early age, you know, boys will develop those social skills more so than anything else. and girls will develop those other skills and more of, out of necessity, as you say. And it, it seems that, you know, maybe for the younger girl who has a lot of demands on her time in her life, she may be drawn more to that release, you know, of being around someone that doesn't require much of her other than her just be who she is. And I just was wondering how that translates in terms of what she looks for later, because like you said, you know, we're pretty much in the war trying to get our young men back in, reel them back in.
I think to our caller and Dr. Borland, I think the way that society, we're given a set of skills, whether we adopt those from our environment, that we have to live. You know, we have to live and we have to survive. And so you adapt those survival, those skills based on your environment. And there's a lot of research that have been done on socialization, white women's socialization, black women's socialization, how we were socialized in order to adopt our leadership skills. And I can't think of it. One of the researchers out of Rutgers University, Ogilvy, last name Ogilvy, I've used her in a research, but she looks at how we were socialized. We were socialized based on our environment and our condition. And just like I said, the kind of composition of the household, you're almost like water. You fill in. If the black man is not there, or if the man is not there, the women or whoever there, they fill in those roles in order to make it work and to make it last and survive. And so I think that's what you're seeing. And the, even when you're, you know, I grew up in a two-parent household, mother and a father, but my father, he was one that always instilled, you need to take care of your own because you're not, you may not have a man around like I am in the household. So even those messages got transcended at a very young age that, hey, the way that we're seeing the world, you may be all by yourself, baby girl, and these are the tools that you have to use in order to be independent. Now, once I got older, what I learned personally is that sometimes I had to step back, and I didn't know how to do that all the time. I didn't know how to let a man lead all the time. And I'm not ashamed of this. I didn't know how to do that because I had been leading and been independent for so long, it felt I felt vulnerable. I didn't know how to be vulnerable. I didn't know how to just trust and let go and say, baby, you got it. I trust that you got it. Now go handle that. I didn't know how to do that. And so I think some of those patterns, some of those things have to be learned. But the first order of business is that we have to survive as a people. And if it took sister, auntie, grandma, sister, nene, paran, you know, godmother, to fill in because we didn't have our men there, then we were going to do it just so that the race could survive. We love our men. Mm-hmm. We love black men. Trust me, we love y'all. We love you to death, but we don't know what's happening. That's a whole different conversation. We don't know what's happening. And where you are in the game with us. We're just holding it down. You know how somebody say, I'm holding it down for you? That's the role I see black women. We're just holding it down. I don't know how long we can hold it down, but we're holding it down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Carla?
Oh, yeah. That you know, that makes so much sense. And I was going to say something, but I didn't want to stir the waters.
We're just holding it down.
I went through a phase, and I'm just going to be honest, I went through a phase, and I'm like, man, because I prefer to you know, be with black women, you know, because it's looking at someone who looks like you, and you have this bond. But I went through this phase where it's like, man, they don't need anything, really. I mean, what can I really give you? You know, and then it's this interracial phase for a long time, and it was like, well, you know, gee, I can bring something to the table over here. I can't bring anything to the table over there.
Right.
Right.
Well, thank you for calling us, caller. You have added richly to our conversation here. Dr. Borland, as we end our hour here with Cultural Conversation, is there any lasting thoughts that you would like to impart on us? You give a dynamic article. You wrote a dynamic article. I would like you to tell people where that article can be located, what's the full name of the article, and where are you blogging? Where could they reach you?
Well, the name of the article is A Black Mother's Love or What Love Looks Like in Public. It is available on the crunkfeministcollective.com. And that's where I blog regularly with the Crunk Feminist Collective at crunkfeministcollective.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at Crunk Feminist.
Great, great. Well, I want to thank you for joining me tonight, Dr. Borland. You have added
richly.
Yeah, you have added richly to the collection. And whether you have children or not, you have a perspective. You're looking at it dually, because you're looking at it from a researcher's lens, which is great. But you're also looking at it from, you've been raised by Black women. You have Black women all around you, especially in the South. They don't bite their tongue.
not at all.
You know, Oprah and The Color Purple, that kind of figure, that was what I grew up with, and I'm pretty sure you did too.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
you have added richly to this conversation, so I want to thank you for joining me tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
And guess what? I'm probably going to have you on for another topic. So, you know, let's keep the emails going back and forth. And whatever you need here from Cultural Conversation, we'll be glad to give it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I look forward to it.
Okay. Thank you very, very much. Well, we want to thank all of our listening audience tonight for listening, for participating in our chat room. Chat room was hot tonight, and also for our call-in. Thank you for calling in, Dr. Robin Boylan. Please go out and check out her article and check out our other blog post, A Black Mother's Love or What Love Looks Like in Public. That's the hot post that she did. It has gone viral. She puts it out there. She lays it out. That's her view. She is a researcher. She backs it up with a lot of her research interest and also her personal observation on the whole Toya Graham snatching her son, making him listen, and actually saving him from maybe going to jail, having a jail term like this other kid who's now has, what, a $500,000 bond or whatever, just getting in all kind of deep trouble. So go out. Look at that article, A Black Mother's Love, or What Love Looks Like in Public. It's on Crunk Feminist Collective website. You want to research Dr. Robin Boylan, B-O-Y-L-O-R-N, and she's a dynamic educator writer with Crunk Feminist Collective, and her article is A Black Mother's Love, or What Love Looks Like in Public. It goes from what jumped off in Baltimore. The article hit last weekend, and it talks about Toya Graham, and it talks about some other mothers where their behavior had to be tempered because of how society expects Black women to discipline and act in public. And so the very powerful and moving article, jump in, put your two cents into it. I want to thank you for listening to Cultural Conversations tonight with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. I will be with you next week as we discuss another hot topic. Thank you. Have a wonderful week.
Sitting out on the edge of paradise. Every inch on your skin.
This is Verona Mitchell, and thank you for joining me on Cultural Conversations. At Cultural Conversations, we're bringing weekly cultural issues and topics to our online studio. Join me next week as we bring more of Cultural Conversations. Thank you for joining me. See you next week.